This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. At the end of the First World War, Black Americans were optimistic that they might be embarking on a new journey of peace. Black soldiers who fought in the war were hopeful that their efforts, fighting for their country, would be enough to finally grant them equality. But instead, they were greeted with a sweeping racial violence and riots across the country in 1919, a period known as Red Summer. Red Summer included the Chicago race riot of 1919, a week-long time of racial unrest that started on the South Side. But just 2 years earlier, in 1917, the city of East St. Louis in Illinois erupted with a racial terror of its own. Tensions started growing after thousands of Black Americans had moved there to work in war factories. And the race war began after white workers went on strike when hundreds of Black people were hired, leading to a 3-day period of terrible violence. To talk about these two episodes, we are joined by Cameron McWhirter, who's a Wall Street Journal reporter and author of Red Summer, The Summer of 1919 and the Awakening of Black America. Cameron, thank you for being with us.
Glad to be here.
We also have twin brothers, Toddie and Terry Kennedy, whose father was living in East St. Louis at the time of the massacre. Thank you for being here to share your family story with us as well.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Listeners, if you have a question or comment for our guests, you can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. Cameron, I want to begin with you. What was the Red Summer?
Well, that phrase was coined by James Weldon Johnson, who was an executive in the NAACP at the time. And he called it that because it was so bloody. In that, we had just finished World War I and the United States had been victorious. So I think a lot of people think back on that era as though it were a wildly successful, happy time. But in fact, it was a very much a panicky time, and race relations, the old fault line that always causes problems in American society, erupted. And there was violence. You mentioned Chicago. That was probably the worst riot of the year, but there were riots in Washington, D.C. You know, there was gunfire right outside of the White House. There were riots in Omaha, Nebraska, all over the South, lynchings. Even out to San Francisco and down to Bisbee, Arizona, there was racial unrest.
You know, and one of the reasons we're having this conversation, Cameron, is there's been so much attention on the Tulsa massacre this month, being the 100 years since it happened. There've been a lot of news stories nationally on that. People don't talk as much about the Chicago riots. Maybe you can give us a little background. What were the tensions in Chicago that led up to this terrible incident in 1919?
Well, I did write a book about it. I mean, it's very complicated, of course.
Yeah,
but to briefly, you know, during World War I, as you mentioned at the beginning, a lot of soldiers went over, African-American soldiers went over to fight for America. And certainly when they came back, had expectations they would be treated as equal citizens. And that certainly was not the case. At the same time, because immigration from Europe basically stopped during the war, a lot of American industry turned to the South and turned to bringing African Americans up, not only to be workers in the factories, but also they were sort of built-in strike breakers because a lot of the unions were very racist at the time and weren't allowing Black people to join. So they were, industry invited them into places like Chicago. But as soon as they arrived, they found that the racial tensions rose over housing, over schooling, over where people could go in public spaces. So what happens in 1919 is it's incredibly hot in the summer of that year, and Black people were basically restricted to a thin strip of what is of the South Side. And so to go to the beach was a sort of a dangerous effort, and a group of young boys, young teenagers, go to the beach that day in July to swim, and they meet white people a white man who doesn't want them to coming to the part of the beach that he was at, and starts throwing stones at them. One boy drowns, and all hell breaks loose, basically.
Yeah, is that that's Eugene Williams.
Correct. Yeah. And certainly that was a horrible incident that ignited it, but the kindling was there. There were strong and persistent racial tensions between white people and black people in the city that had been festering for quite a while.
Yeah. All right. Let's pause on Chicago for a moment. Terry, I want to bring you into the conversation. When did you first learn about the massacre in East St. Louis? It was 2 years earlier, 1917. But when did you first learn about your family's connection to this? I mean, did you know about it growing up, or was it something you found out about when you were older?
Okay, thank you. And this is Thady, by the way. I knew about it growing up. My father and my uncles were still living and are alive, and we heard about it from them.
And is it something that was talked about in school as well, or just in your family?
Absolutely not. Yeah, the schools don't talk about any of that stuff. The schools don't, as far as I'm concerned, don't talk about any real history. You know, one of the first things I learned in school was about George Washington being so honorable. He told his father he chopped down a cherry tree. And I was an adult when I found out that cherry trees weren't even introduced into the U.S. until 1903. No, the schools, particularly not the public schools, talked at all about any of the race wars, the lynchings, and not just the bad things, but achievements that black people made in this country. We have to tell our own narrative, and that's why doing this is important to me.
And Toddy, how did these stories come about? I mean, was it like a sit down, we're going to have a talk about this thing in our family's past, or just kind of mentioned in passing? Go ahead. Yeah.
The stories came about the way my father was raising us. If there was a knock at the door, and you know, at 8 or 9 years old, I go to the door, he'd always caution me to be careful, to peek out. Someone could be standing there with a gun in their hands, ready to shoot you to come in and take your home. Just all kinds of small ways he would say things. And about the time we were 11 or 12, he and my uncles began to talk about that experience in 1917.
Okay, we're going to get into what your family's experience was on the night of July 1st, 1917 in particular. We do need to take a break on the program, though. So I'm just going to remind listeners, if you're just tuning in, we are talking about, obviously, there's been a lot of attention this month in particular on the Tulsa Massacre, but Illinois has its own history of racist violence here. We're talking about the violence in 1917 in East St. Louis, as well as the Chicago race riot in 1919. If you want to join our conversation, the number to call is 800-222-9455. If you have a question, or especially if you have a family connection to one of these events, please share your story with us. 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. After a short break, we're going to continue our conversation with Thady Kennedy and Terry Kennedy, twins whose father was living in East St. Louis at the time of the massacre there, and Cameron McWhorter, who is the author of the book Red Summer, The Summer of 1919 and the Awakening of Black America. More to come after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking with three people about some of the racial violence in Illinois that happened in 1917 and 1919. This was a period of violence across the country, including what we've been talking a lot about here, hearing a lot about this month is the Tulsa Massacre, but Illinois has its own history with these. And we haven't even mentioned the 1908 race riot, so-called race riot in Springfield, Illinois, which gave birth, of course, as our listeners know, to the NAACP. We have talked about that previously on the program. Today, we're focusing on these other two incidents with Cameron McWhirter, author of Red Summer, The Summer of 1919 and the Awakening of Black America. Also, Thadi Kennedy and Terry Kennedy, twin brothers whose father was living in East St. Louis at the time of the massacre there. So, Terry, maybe you can tell us what happened on the night of July 1st, 1917.
I would think to mention several things related. It was our father, our uncles, we had aunts, all that side of the family experienced that East St. Louis race war is what they called it. As the story goes, and we get a very cohesive story from both our father and our uncles and aunts, all who survived it, is that that evening the home was attacked. There was a white mob that both encircled the house in the front and the rear. In the front, they were shooting into the house. In the rear, they had torches, and they were throwing these torches upon the house. The family, our grandmother, grabbed her children. Her brother-in-law, our grandfather's brother, was with them. And they jumped out, opened up a window, and jumped out the side window. That was the only way they could get out. Going from there, there was an open area, and then there was an area of very tall grass. Because it was night, they made it into that area and hid in that grass for several hours, really until the next day, as they lay there quietly, not to be found, and listened to the home being burned to the ground and people shouting and hollering and continuing to shoot into the home, thinking that they were still in there. After that, our grandmother and the others that were with her took the children down to the river. The Eads Bridge, which was one of the major bridges from St. Louis to East St. Louis, was blocked off. On the St. Louis side, the police were not allowing the African-American survivors into the city of St. Louis. There was the same with the Black Bridge, which is further south from the Eads Bridge. This meant then that they had no real way. They couldn't go back across East St. Louis because that was in flames and Black people were being killed. So our grandmother and the other family members made a raft. They put a raft together out of the wood that was left from other homes that were being burned and torn up and other pieces of wood that were there, and placed the children up on that raft with the other family members and came over to the city of St. Louis, crossing the river that way. It is a story that has been passed through this family from that generation before us. All of our cousins know the same story. That tells of their both courage and their strength in making sure that this family survived. If they had not done that, we wouldn't be here talking to you today.
And I understand both of your father's parents, your grandfather went missing. Your grandmother eventually developed pneumonia. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Grandmother did develop pneumonia after this horrific incident. As our brother was saying, they fashioned a raft together with burnt out boards and wood, everything they could find, to make it across the Mississippi River. And from what we've been told, it took them about 4 hours to get across that river to the Illinois, to the Missouri side. A side you can see very clearly. You feel like you could just, it's just so close. But, you know, with the tides and so forth, it was difficult to make it across there. Our grandmother was 34 years old at the time, and we were told, and our father, everybody was told that she died of pneumonia. To me, it sounds very much stress-related, being in the middle of the summer, as it was. But when she died, and my grandfather first being missing and then later discovering that he had been murdered, it left my father and all of his siblings just scattered. They were parentless and homeless at that time, and so young.
And Terry or Dottie, what happened then to your father? What how did he make his way in the world with both his parents?
Well, it was a lot of things happened immediately. This is Terry Kennedy. I know it may sound a little bit alike.
Yeah,
we are twins. I'm the old one. It was difficult. You see, our grandmother's name was Horn. And so both the Horns and Kennedys were in East St. Louis. That meant both sides of the family were really devastated by what happened. And so then they tried to organize as much as they could. And those homes that were left or habitable after that, children from Catherine Kennedy, our grandmother, were kind of passed around from various family members. And then finally, the city of Kinloch was developed. As you know, the city of Kinloch, a lot of the survivors of the East St. Louis race riot were relocated there. So we had family in Kinloch, and our father and his uncle, his brothers, would walk from East St. Louis along the train tracks to Kinloch. They sometimes found themselves living in a shanty town that was right down by the river, building it out of various materials that they could find. Our father, later on, to make money, began to box for a living in exhibitions and various carnivals that would come in. He told us a story of how he used to wrestle bears. Now, you know, you sometimes think your parents come up with these wild stories, but we got it confirmed from another woman who knew our father that said, you know, boys, your father used to wrestle bears for money. And so he did what he could until finally he landed a job at what was called the Burkhart Phone Making Company. And then from there, he became the head of his union, and then later an elected official, an alderman in the city of St. Louis. Right. So it was very difficult during that time period, because then shortly thereafter, by the time he reached the teens, the Great Depression hit. And so the bottom dropped out of everything. Our uncle, his brother, told the story of how he said he had learned that if you stayed out in the cold long enough, you would no longer be cold, and then you would die. And he had made up his mind one day that he had no place to go, that he was just going to die that evening. And a man told him, look, come and stay in my barn. And he made up his mind that day that he was no longer going to be poor. And so our uncle, our father's brother, did end up becoming the leading bail bondsman, black bail bondsman in the city of St. Louis.
I'd like to add too that Kinloch is in Missouri. Kinloch, Missouri was an old small black town in the suburbs around the city of St. Louis.
Yeah, so right by Missouri. By the St. Louis Airport.
Okay, Cameron McWhorter, I want to bring you back into the conversation now. Author of Red Summer, The Summer of 1919, and The Awakening of Black America. Earlier, we were talking about the violence in Chicago in 1919. I want to ask you, I don't want to get hung up on the language. You know, there have been, initially, a lot of these were called race riots. Some have now come to be called massacres. I think it's interesting to note, though, my understanding is in Chicago, there was fighting. Black Americans defended themselves, especially World War I veterans who had been trained in the military. I wonder if you can talk about, you know, that aspect of this and how some of these, you know, were massacres, how some of them were actually, you know, more battles. I don't know if there's, take that where you will.
No, I think that's a very good point. I would, just on East St. Louis, I think it's important to note that Josephine Baker, the famous singer, was in St. Louis at that time and witnessed the people like the Kennedys pouring over the river to St. Louis. And she described it as an apocalypse. And that definitely shaped her trajectory of her career, because she went to Europe and didn't really want to come back to the United States. And it also formed the political views of a lot of African-American political leaders, including W.E. Du Bois. So when 1919 starts erupting, a lot of the leadership of the NAACP and others are very aware of what had occurred in East St. Louis and want to try to stop that sort of violence from happening. And and to your point, there's a lot of African Americans who've just had enough of this. And there was a famous poet named Claude McKay. He wasn't famous at the time, but he worked as a railroad porter, and he wrote a small sonnet that year called If We Must Die, which goes into, it's basically, it doesn't mention race, but in that poem, you have a man saying, I'm not going to take this anymore, and I will die fighting. And every American in the country eventually saw that poem, because it was published all over the place. And a lot of African Americans who read that poem said, yeah, that's exactly what I'm feeling right now. And so when Chicago erupts, there are many, many Black people who are working outside of the Black, what was called the Black Belt, and they are attacked as they try to come home from work or from, you know, traveling into the city. But there are lots of white people who are attacked who are in the Black Belt as well. So it becomes a giant battle. And it isn't really stopped until finally the state troopers are sent in.
And you know, a lot of people have been looking back on these events and thinking about what's been happening in recent years in America, right? Last summer, we saw a racial uprising and strife following the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and so many others. Do you see, Cameron McWhorter, parallels between the Red Summer of 1919 and what's been happening recently in America?
I see echoes. I think that if James Weldon Johnson and W.E. Du Bois could be brought back to life to see the protests that took place last summer, they would be weeping with gratitude and joy at the fact that there were other races joining in this cause. I think, but I also feel that certainly the police, the relationship between the African-American community and the police today is directly, you could draw direct parallels to what was going on then. And that for people who have, who are not Black and don't have an understanding or don't quite comprehend why African-Americans are so angry about a lot of the things that have happened, they need to understand American history and go back to years like 1919, when there would be a riot and it would be and white mobs would attack Black communities or Black individuals, and the police would basically do very little to try to stop it. Yeah, and that occurred over and over again throughout 1919, whether it was in deep in Mississippi or up in Chicago.
Yeah, and I'll just indicate to listeners, stay tuned. In the coming weeks, we're scheduled to have a conversation with Elizabeth Hinton, who's a professor. She has a book drawing this exact direct connection that you were talking about between...
May I make a comment?
...in the past. Please, go ahead. I should say we only have a couple of minutes left in the program, but go ahead.
I can be very quick. The elders that we know were victimized, but they did not see themselves as victims. That's why they call it a race war. They fought back. It wasn't just a matter of them being beat up on. They saw themselves as an active participant in defending themselves and didn't always depend upon someone else to do that. And so then I do think, and we do think, that it is important how we shape this and the words that we use in describing it. They never called it a massacre or that they were massacred, but it was a war. And in war, you have two sides fighting one another. In this instance, defending their right to be human beings in America.
Right. That's a great point. I'm really glad you made that, Terry. Just last question to you. How did your family member, your father, your other family members, they survived a race war? How did that affect, you know, how did they handle the emotions of that through the rest of their lives?
Well, they saw a way to allow them to be better people and then to teach the history, not only of that, but the importance of the unification of our families and our community. Each one of them became active members in trying to make change in the community, each and every one of them. And then they helped the next generation do the same. And so then, you know, our cousin from that became the first Black student at an all-white school. You know, my mother and fathers were all involved in not only the civil rights movement, but we as well in what was considered to be the Black Power movement and the empowerment movement. It made us an activist family. Yeah. And to see the need that the only way to make change, you will have to put energy in your hands and yourself into it. Okay. And so that is what we get from that, not seeing themselves as victims or that some great thing happened so badly that the family could not continue. Mm-hmm. To the contrary.
And that's a great story for the Kennedys. I will say that in researching my book, I encountered families that 90 years later wouldn't discuss and were afraid to discuss some of the things that had happened to them.
Wow.
They were very slow to discuss
it. I'm sorry to interrupt. We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank Terry Kennedy and Thadi Kennedy for sharing their family stories, and Cameron McWhorter, author of Red Summer, The Summer of 1919, and The Awakening of Black America. That's it for our program today. Thanks for listening.